welcome to Dissecting Philosophy with Dr. McDonald. In this episode, we'll be continuing on reading through Herbert Marcuse's One-Dimensional Man, this time getting stuck into Chapter 6, which is called Technological Rationality and the Logic of Domination. So, as we always like to do, we're going to have a brief recap of the last episode covering Chapter 5. Then we'll get stuck into the idea of perpetual struggle and why exactly is there a perpetual struggle built into society. Then we'll be having a look at science and the scientific method, and then rounding off with a discussion of how the scientific method is used and adopted to analyze society itself. So, starting off with a recap of the last episode then, in Chapter 5, there was a big discussion about philosophy itself, and that was because we went all the way back to ancient Greece and the philosophies of Aristotle and Plato. And what exactly was all the move for this? What's all the moving and shaking and discussion about? That is, in philosophy, there is a search for truth. There's a move away from uncertainty towards certainty, or another way of putting that is there's a move away from chaos towards stability. What is the thing that then allows us to attain truth in the first place is intuition. And then there's also a focus upon the role of the philosopher themselves, their intuition and methodology in order to arrive at the truth. And we saw this within the discussion of Plato's Meno. Who is the one that allowed Meno to arrive at the truth? Was Socrates. And what exactly is the methodology going to establish to arrive at truth is the one that Plato himself is going to have talked about within the dialogue. And then we had that nice overlap into various different other philosophies, because what is one of the main goals of any philosophy, regardless whether it's empiricism, rationalism, existentialism, and so on, all of them provide various different methodologies for analyzing the world and understanding the world. So there's this move away from chaotic basis, instability, towards stability and certainty. And then we also had this discussion in establishing a certain foundation for truth. There's a move away from the world, traditionally within philosophy, towards metaphysics. And this is because truth itself, if you place it upon the world, it seemed to be something that's always in continual flux and continual change. That means the very idea of truth itself would be always in continual change. And traditionally within philosophy, people don't like the idea of a truth that changes. Why not? Because they believe precisely in the opposite of that, that if it's true, it's going to be something that's always going to be eternal, everlasting, unchanging, and all those qualities. So therefore, what allows for that to take place is that move away from the world towards metaphysics. That allows for a nice foundation and basis for our understanding, and as well for ethics and so on. And then we have this similar move that we discussed as well in Plato's Meno. There's this move away from the world. Knowledge is not based upon our experience, but ultimately knowledge is based upon recollection. What is that again? Just briefly, that ultimately Plato's idea of knowledge comes down to the theory of recollection, which is to say that everything is emphasized upon the soul. The soul is the thing that contains knowledge. Why is that the case? Because then it goes into a theory of reincarnation. The soul has lived throughout countless numbers of lives. In doing so, it's learned everything there is to learn. And in doing so, what ultimately do we do when we learn is that we recollect the knowledge of past lives that's contained innately within the soul. And therefore, you have that great question of, well, why don't we just all immediately be geniuses, all immediately just have that capability to just unlock everything if the soul's learned everything there is to possibly learn? Then goes into that reply to say, well, Plato's theory also says that within each process of reincarnation, there's also this whole process of having to start from scratch every single time. So it's ultimately like starting over on a fresh blank VHS tape, although it's quite, of course, an old example now to use. But ultimately, you start over with a blank slate every single time, and every single time you have to recollect all that knowledge all over again. So from this discussion of philosophy itself and what does philosophy do in this whole relation into truth and this move towards metaphysics, there's also this discussion of how philosophers have also privileged an intellectual life. And that's the way in which Mark Hughes, of course, starts to problematize, is because what exactly happens in privileging an intellectual life is that it precisely doesn't care about a life of manual labor, which is another way to say it is that philosophy doesn't care about the majority of people who are precisely the ones that do manual labor in the first place. And also, it doesn't care about the lives of slaves either, which of course is a key crucial part of everyday life within ancient Greece. So here you have the whole move in philosophy towards an intellectual life. Therefore, you have to be a philosopher in order to gain a true knowledge and understanding of the world. Only through their methodologies do you gain an understanding of what truth is. Everybody else is ultimately left completely on the lurch, is a nice way to put it. Everybody's completely left behind following on from that. And why is that the case? Because they don't care about everybody. They only care about those people who are going to be the knowledge seekers, the philosophers in the first place. So also built into this as well, interestingly enough, is not only do you have a privilege of a very minor sect of people within the overall population in the first place, and not caring about the majority of people, you also have built into their ethics as well, like the philosophy of the good life, for instance, is equally privileged just solely to philosophers. Aristotle, for instance, argues that the best form of life possible is the intellectual life. Another example is that Plato says that ultimately philosophers are the ones that are able to know precisely how to keep their soul pure better than absolutely everybody else. And so they have the best form of the afterlife possible. So we have this immense privileging of specifically philosophy, philosophical discipline itself, philosophical method and understanding over and above all the other various different disciplines, as well as not caring about the majority of people whatsoever. Because we always come back into that point. All the various different oppositional views are always argued to be incorrect because only the philosopher's method is always argued to be the correct way to do things. Then we had rounding off of the last episode quite a nice discussion about dialectics and dialectical reasoning. And that was sort of way in which Mark Hughes says, well, really rounding off for that last chapter, it's really ending up to be, well, what is a positive philosophical method that you could ultimately have? What is something beneficial? And he says, well, dialectical reasoning is something that's beneficial. Why? Because suddenly truth within dialectics is no longer just truth with a capital T, not something that's just pure anymore. Why is that? Because when you put it into dialectics, suddenly truth becomes historical. And therefore, when that happens, that means that how a person thinks within a specific time period is ultimately going to affect how they think and what philosophical methods and so forth that they construct. And so you no longer arrive at absolutely pure truth anymore, but also you allow for multiple oppositional views to whatever the method would be. Let's say you would have an argument for various different other viewpoints, let's say we used in the last episode as well. What about the Stoics, for instance? What about Epicurus as two alternative examples? Because this is another key problem within philosophy itself. Not only does it argue that philosophers are the best people to arrive at truth, there's also built into the philosophical methods themselves this whole sense of egoism and whole sense of, well, my method is the absolute best, and I don't care for what anybody else says, because how everybody else thinks is incorrect. And you have, of course, that example within Aristotle. In the start of Book One of the Metaphysics, for example, talks about the pre-Socratics and then talks about Plato, identifies all the problems with them, and then immediately says, well, who's the one that arrives at the best form of knowledge? It's in fact, oh, me! Hooray! So therefore, I'm going to tell you exactly how I think. But therefore, you're seeing exactly what Marcuse is saying. Here we have an incredible benefit of dialectics and dialectical reasoning. Not only do we pop truth away from this idea of a pure truth into historical truth, so therefore, truth itself becomes part of various different social and cultural forces and so on. But also, you allow for various different oppositional views out with whoever it would be that would be arguing for it. So it removes and problematizes that whole role of egoism, as well as trying to privilege out one specific overall methodology as the dominant one. So let's move on then from our recap into a discussion of Chapter 6. And Chapter 6 starts us off with a look at how technology has transformed our understanding. And how is that exactly? Because the technological transformation of nature, in which, of course, science plays a role, has moved the base of domination, as Marcuse says, from people being reliant upon masters or the lord of the manor, let's say in like serfdom society, to now being dependent upon economic laws and the market, for instance. So now domination, he says, is of a higher order, one that's not based upon an actual person like a lord, but now is based upon a set of structures like the economic structure. So therefore, people are dependent upon these structures in order for them to live, but at the same time, they become enslaved by the perpetual struggle for existence. And this is really the key question for Chapter 6, is that given the fact that we have now a reliance upon specific structures because the structures themselves, like the economic structure, is very much dominant upon everybody's life, now we have built into the very structure that works within society a perpetual struggle that happens. What exactly is that struggle? It's one of the things in which Marcuse states in the interview that's available on YouTube for under Biophily 2, in which Marcuse argues that what is the main purpose of society, or one of the main purposes of society, and one of the whole things in which people have to do is to go out and to work. Why is that the case? Because ultimately everybody needs money to live. And so therefore you have built into this entire structure a whole move towards everybody needing to struggle to survive in the first place. And there's this key question then of why is society built in such a way that it perpetuates this struggle for existence, that you have a bunch of people ultimately at the bottom of the system struggling to live, and you have, on the other hand, a bunch of other people not struggling and being quite happy with their existence. Why exactly is this perpetual struggle necessary, and where exactly did this whole idea of perpetual struggle come from in the first place? And so we get really an answer to that through a whole quite detailed and dense discussion of scientific method within Chapter 6. And that's to say, what is the thing that allows for this perpetual struggle to exist? And one of the answers for that is going to be because of the role of science. So let's move into the discussion of the scientific method itself. And that is, we've had then, within Chapter 5, this immense role upon philosophy and the role of metaphysics to arrive at truth. Now we go into Chapter 6 and something big happens. What exactly is that big shift and move? Is that when you arrive at truth in Chapter 6, what has exactly happened is that we have, with this incredible emphasis upon the scientific method proceeding on from the Enlightenment period, now we don't rely upon philosophy to determine exactly what truth is. Now we don't rely upon metaphysics whatsoever, but what exactly is that understanding that allows us to get towards truth is science and the scientific method. So therefore there's that move away from metaphysics towards science, and a move towards the world. And so now we have this big shift coming back into the world again. As we've seen traditionally within philosophy, there's that move out of the world because everything's in continual flux and continual change. Therefore, a good question from the philosophy side of things, at least traditionally, would be, how can you justify knowledge if it's going to be in this state of continual change and continual flux? And one of the answers that science gives back is that there's precisely a move back into the world because it's through the use of quantifiable observation and measurement that allows us to understand the world itself. And so here, quite interestingly enough, there's a really lovely overlap between mathematics and philosophy and mathematics and science. As we said in chapter 5, within Plato's philosophy, there's that incredible emphasis upon mathematics. Why is that the case? Because mathematical truths themselves are always eternal, unchanging, and always the same. So go back into always that easy enough example. 2 + 2 will always equal 4, regardless of what society we're in, regardless of what time period we're in. And so therefore, mathematics takes upon an incredibly key, crucial role for exactly how do you understand the world? Why? Because it allows for that form of stability and form of knowledge to emerge that's always going to be the same. And fights against any form of change and flux and so on, everything that they don't want in traditionally within philosophy. Now you have that move back into the world, as we just said, that key crucial question as well. If everything changes in the world, how can you justify scientific knowledge? Why is there not that move towards metaphysics again? And it's quite an easy enough answer that scientists give back, is to say, well, we also like mathematics too, because when we use precisely mathematical analysis, as we said, quantifiable observation and measurement, which is just another way, a posh way of saying, how do we arrive at precisely knowledge of the world through experimentation? That's to say, through experimentation, you have the analysis of the world, whatever it would be, within whichever scientific discipline it would be. And therefore, through that, you're able to have very set conditions, which are very much controlled. And therefore, you would arrive at a set of results that either backs up the hypothesis or ultimately cancels it out. And it's as simple as that. So ultimately, therefore, we have this relation and development from the Enlightenment period then to say, well, from this understanding of the world and nature, how exactly does this develop? Is, of course, through analyzing the material world as precisely a collection of materials. It's all a set of things to be used and analyzed in order to understand the world itself. And when we understand the world itself, therefore we're able to organize it and categorize it, as everybody's done so from the Enlightenment period onwards, through various different categories of whether it belongs to physics, biology, chemistry, and so on. So that nicely then explains that move in a way from metaphysics and philosophy into science and scientific understanding, with that emphasis upon quantifiable observation and measurement. But then also Marcuse makes an interesting relation and discussion into neutrality that's also within scientific observation, is to say, well, what is a scientific observation going to be? Is something that's unbiased and allows for an objective approach to be affirmed, which is another way to say backing up all the experimentation is that a scientist has always got to be unbiased, so their own personal opinion never affects what's stated. So that is to say, regardless of where they are in the world, their society, their culture, their beliefs and so forth will not affect the experiment and what exactly results will be arrived at. And therefore, everything's kept incredibly controlled as well as incredibly objective. But here, what's interesting is, and is not at all surprising, is that Marcuse says, well, yes, you have trying to be affirmed a neutrality within science, but ultimately the problem is that the neutrality can turn quite political, which is another way to say is, irregardless of what the science tries to do, you can ultimately have a government come in or a set of thinkers come in and hijack the science in order for them to try and justify their own beliefs and opinions. And got a great quote here from page 160. Scientific rationality makes for a specific societal organization precisely because it projects mere form or mere matter here. The otherwise opposite terms converge, which can be bent to practically all ends. And so that's the key point in which Marcuse wants to make about scientific neutrality, is that the science itself can be bent practically to all ends. And of course, the examples of that is not very hard to think of when you think of, well, what's the way in which science is used bent to try and justify things, is all what we have to do is go into the Nazi regime within World War II, or we go into Soviet Russia, where they both used science to, for the Nazis, justify eugenics on the one hand, and then for communism to justify their own form of pseudoscience on the other. And why was that, of course, used? Why was science so much emphasized upon? Because it goes back into all those points, is that now we have post-Enlightenment period, this incredible focus upon scientific truth. We accept scientific truth at face value and accept everything that scientists say to us. Therefore, why wouldn't a government use scientists to try and back up its own forms of pseudoscience and complete nonsense? And that's one of the ways in which we had that lovely discussion within Hannah Arendt as well, is that they chose specifically prominent academics and prominent scientists who were made to say absolute complete rubbish, all to justify what the regime was talking about. It makes it look good, of course, to an international arena in which you have prominent scientists and so forth making claims and so on. And then all of it is, of course, just complete PR. It's all just made to try and make the regime look good and what they say have a form of justification behind it. And another example of that out with the Nazis and communism is, of course, social Darwinism. And I want to just build upon this a little bit as an idea, just because it's so interesting. And this is from the website historyhit.com. What is social Darwinism and how was it used in Nazi Germany? So we don't need to touch upon the Nazi Germany part of it. As it says, rather than Darwin, social Darwinism is derived most directly from the writings of Herbert Spencer, who believed that human societies developed like natural organisms. He conceived the idea of the struggle for survival and suggested that this drove an inevitable progress in society. It broadly meant evolving from the barbarian stage of society to the industrial stage. It was Spencer who termed the coin survival of the fittest, which is of course a very well-known phrase now that's attributed to Darwin incorrectly, and he opposed any laws that helped workers, the poor, and those he deemed genetically weak, of the infirm and incapacitated. Spencer once said, it's better that they should die. So, of course, we're dealing with an absolutely horrible piece of work here for Herbert Spencer. Rounding off, it says, although Spencer was responsible for much of the foundational discourse of social Darwinism, Darwin did say that human progress was driven by evolutionary processes, that human intelligence was refined by competition. Finally, the actual term social Darwinism was originally coined by Thomas Malthus, who is better remembered for his iron rule of nature and the concept of struggle for existence. So here we have absolutely heinous idea in which you use specifically Darwin and Darwinian theory and then manipulate it and use it to try and justify your own means. And that's exactly what you have within Herbert Spencer, as well as Thomas Malthus, who's also responsible for population control as well as an idea. And you can see from that how they take Darwin's precisely idea and twist it to try and mean something completely else, put a political edge to it ultimately. And that's where no longer is it just in this sense of dealing with evolutionary progress, but no, rather we have this incredibly heinous idea that somehow those who are infirm, incapacitated, disabled, and so forth, are those who have evolved in an evolutionary progress in a weak way, and therefore, who are the ones that have evolved in a good way, therefore, is going to be the rich and the wealthy. So absolutely heinous man, heinous individual, and social Darwinism is another reason for why people were thrown into mental asylums and so forth, because arguing that they're genetically weaker and therefore they should be thrown into asylums and so forth and just forgotten about and left to die, basically. So building upon this then, we have another point that Marcuse makes in a critical way for a scientific theory, although I don't think any scientists themselves would disagree with what Marcuse has to say, and that is building upon what was argued the positive aspects of dialectical reasoning, that is to say, we have suddenly an input in of social and historical and cultural forces and so forth. Equally, Marcuse makes the point of, well, scientific methods and what they argue for their ideas of truth, on the one hand, they argue to be universal and objective, but ultimately, he says, they're going to be based upon those social and historical conditions in which they were written. And then quite interestingly enough is while we have this lovely discussion that happens within chapter 6 to say that the advancement in scientific techniques and modes of analysis will change our overall conclusions as well as how we understand and view the world. And of course, a great example of that is the particle accelerator, in which that precisely changes how we understand the world itself and atomic theory and so on. But just a great example there to back up exactly what Marcuse says. When you have precisely that advancement in science with precisely the particle accelerator, then that allows us to have a completely different understanding of how things work. We've got a great quote here from page 168. The quantification of qualities which yield exactness as well as universal validity involve a concrete experience of the Lebenswelt, a specific mode of seeing the world. So for those particular points, I don't think that any scientist would be particularly shocked by those critical comments, because they would pretty much agree with Marcuse, who would believe that in the one hand, what they write is always going to be determined by the social, historical, cultural forces and so on. Basically, their own time and location, as well as where they're writing it and why they're writing it, will always have been affected in some way. And so it can never be completely, absolutely objective. So next, let's move on to the discussion of where science then is used in relation to society, which is to say that the quantifiable observation and measurement of nature done by science was then applied to a quantifiable observation and measurement of society. And we have great quote here from pages 160 to 161, which states, "While science freed nature from the inherent ends and stripped matter of all but quantifiable qualities, society freed men from the natural hierarchy of personal dependence and related them to each other in accordance with quantifiable qualities, namely, as units of abstract labor power, calculable in units of time." And this is a quote he has borrowed here from Adorno and Horkheimer's book, which is called Dialectics of Enlightenment, and it states, "By virtue of the rationalization of the modes of labor, the elimination of qualities is transferred from the universe of science to that of daily experience." And there's another great quote here from page 162 that states, "This scientific method, which led to ever more effective domination of nature, thus came to provide the pure concepts as well as the instrumentalities for the ever more effective domination of man by man through the domination of nature." So ultimately then we have the use of science itself applied back into society, where we have no longer just somebody toiling away at work as something to be produced. Let's say within Marx's industrial period, you would have a bunch of workers and so forth all toiling away and producing quantities of goods and so forth. But now with the list of signs, we have a relation of everyday life and work to quantifiable qualities that can be measured. So now the workers and their time are now analyzed in terms of labor power, and products are calculated in units of time, which is another way of just saying how much time is needed for product Y to be produced. Ultimately, how much labor power and so forth and how much effort is needed in order for somebody to produce a certain product, how fast therefore can that product be produced, and how much quantity of that product can be produced in that amount of time given. So therefore we have all this incredible focus upon precisely productivity, and we have this relation of productivity in relation to, of course, profits at the same time, with this immense emphasis upon technology, because technology is the thing that's used to increase profits as well as productivity, because technology makes the production of goods faster. So overall, what is Marcuse trying to say then? From this, everybody can start to hopefully see that we have within this whole scientific quantifiable measurements and so forth, that no longer is it just about somebody producing goods. Now, once you view things in terms of labor power and precisely in terms of productivity and how much profit you can get out of it, then that has an immense impact upon precisely how people work and the administrative side of how things are implemented into it, and allows for that domination of man by the structure that's applied to them, by all of that administrative side of it. As we've said before, we have that move from Marx's industrial period, where you have that clear worker-boss dynamic that goes on. But on the other hand, when you move into 1960 society, what Marcuse is saying, we have all this relation into administration. Through that administration, bosses and the workers themselves are both subject to exactly the same rules. And what's all those rules going to focus on is the key points of productivity and profit. And so the very means of how the boss interacts to the workers all going to be making sure that everybody hits their targets. For instance, if you have to sell a certain amount of goods and so forth, if it's in retail environment, everybody has to try and sell a certain amount and trying to upsell a bunch of attached goods onto the goods that they're trying to sell as well. As well as then you have the boss say, well, you're not hitting these targets anymore. You need to be better. You need to be more productive. And then also you could see, well, the boss is not running the shop very well. Why not? Because their overall workers are not hitting their targets. And therefore we need to come in and say, you need to work, you need to hit those targets much better. And being able to sell vast quantities that we attribute to you, that's achievable. Then, of course, that leads to competition between shops and so forth. Therefore, you have, like, within the region, the best shop at the top who's selling the most vast quantity of goods and going over and above their targets. And then you have that, of course, tier system and tier structure to say, well, the shop under that's doing slightly worse. And then you have, of course, the ones right at the bottom who are struggling in comparison to the ones at the top. And you create all that competitive structure and environment by focusing on productivity and profits at the same time. And through this focus upon productivity and profit, and through the use of quantifiable data and what could be measured and so forth, we have incredibly totalitarian style of structure. And there's a great quote here that I want to discuss from Noam Chomsky, who's professor at MIT in linguistics. And this is just from a clip that I found on YouTube, as he states, almost everybody spends most of their life living in a totalitarian system. It's called having a job. When you have a job, you're under total control of the masters of the enterprise. They determine what you wear when you go to the bathroom. The very idea of a wage contract is selling yourself into servitude. These are private governments. They're more totalitarian than most governments are. They can control everything you do. If people argue, on the other hand, that you're free to leave at any time, Chomsky replies back to that, yes, you're free to starve. You have a choice between starving or selling yourself to a tyranny. And that really touches upon, I think, one of the key crux problems that Marcuse is also highlighting here within Chapter 6, is that we have this incredible totalitarian nature of precisely work. Why is this emerged? Because we have the adoption and use of scientific techniques and approach adopted from the scientific analysis of nature, now moved into the realm of work. And once you do that, what exactly happens is that work then becomes a totalitarian style of structure, in which we're building upon those points of the administrative side of things, precisely determining exactly what people wear when you go to the bathroom, and the whole idea of really having no other choice but to go to work in the first place, to earn a living, to pay the bills, to get food. Or if you don't, then you're ultimately gonna starve. As he says, you've got that choice between starving or selling yourself to a tyranny, and we have really no other option but to go to work in the first place. Which then, this nicely builds into a quote from Marcuse from the interview from 1964, which is on the YouTube channel Biophily 2, in which Marcuse states, what is wrong with society is that it retains, that it perpetuates the struggle for existence, toil, frustration, waste. Although all the intellectual and material capabilities are there to pacify this struggle for existence in the international arena as well as within the nation and for the private individual. By pacification of the struggle for existence, I mean something very concrete. I expressed it in the phrase, the abolition of alienated labor. We have reached the stage where industrial civilization really could reduce working time to such an extent that the traditional proportion between working time and free time is reversed, that free time becomes full time and working time is marginal time. This would involve a complete transvaluation of values. It would cancel some of the most cherished taboos of established civilization. For example, the need for earning a living instead of making a life an end in itself, and not a means to attain an end, which is never attained or only an age where you could no longer enjoy it anymore. This, I think, today is the alternative, and I think this alternative is systematical, and it is prevented by the way in which we continue the established erection of progress. So here, from the discussion from 1964, we have precisely Marcuse make the point. Well, here we have perpetual struggle for existence built into society. And from that, he clearly states as well, there can be a switch around to where this is pacified. What exactly does this pacification mean? Is precisely we switch everything around to its opposite. So we no longer have the working time is the majority time and free time is marginalized. We ultimately have free time is the greater part of the time, whilst is working time is marginalized. But as he says, in order to arrive at this completely different understanding of how work functions, it would require complete transvaluation of values. It's a nice Nietzsche concept there. And it would cancel out some of the most cherished taboos, precisely all those points about that perpetual struggle and needing to earn a living and so forth. But we could see from Marcuse's argument as well that this is problematical. You can't just suddenly arrive at a complete opposite way of doing things incredibly easily. Why not? Because this would mean for it not to be focused upon a perpetual struggle, would mean that it'd have to be a complete move away from viewing everything in terms of production and profit, for instance. There'd have to be a move away from the continual production of new items. And so that's where we go into that last point about it's prevented by the way in which we continue the established erection of progress, is because there's always built into that system new products at the same time that have to be continually produced. Always the new iPhone, always the new tablet and so forth, always something new that's continually produced all the time. And therefore you have built into that, of course, the whole sense of being antiquated, of advertising the brand new things, selling off the old things, and ultimately continually moving towards productivity all the time. Also, another quote from the interview is where he says, a choice to change the situation would require men who live in dire need for such a change, and this dire need is effectively suppressed. It would furthermore require that those people who live in such a change actually have the power to bring the change about. This too, at present, is not the case. Why not? Because precisely society is structured in such a way for pacification, as what Marcuse has argued previously for. People would need to want to have the desire for the need to change everything in the first place, but that desire is repressed. And not only would they want to have to bring it about, they would need to have the power at the same time, which is also not the case. So therefore, we have quite a pessimistic view of things as well, for rounding off on chapter 6, is to say that we have this sense of continual perpetual struggle. We have ultimately a system that continually allows for the struggle to exist. That system in and itself is continually focused upon productivity and profit, as well as the production of new things all the time. And therefore, in order to change that system would mean a complete transvaluation of all values. But ultimately, in order to do anything about it in the first place, there's no set of people to want that change, because everybody's pretty much happy and content within that system. Everybody's pacified. Plus, nobody has the power to do anything about it in the first place. And so, rounding off, we could really think about it in terms of this sort of idea that also South Park presents to us I'm thinking of a clip that I saw on YouTube as well, where Butter's father and a collection of others is all working at the Amazon Fulfillment Center. And that's really one of the key points we could relate it into contemporary society as well, is this is where you have an idea of what Marcuse wants us to think about what work is precisely like, and starting for us to problematize precisely work at the same time. Because you have within that South Park clip Butter's dad going to work at the fulfillment center, ultimately to buy products from Amazon themselves, as well as buy food from Amazon Fresh, as well as for his entertainment uses Amazon Prime. And so what highlights the irony of the situation in South Park is here you have Butter's dad working at the Amazon Fulfillment Center, but ultimately paying back Amazon all the money that he's just made, having worked at Amazon. And ultimately goes back into those points that we made previously, is that we end up in such a situation of this continual perpetual struggle, but ultimately society is structured in such a way to allow for the struggle. And built into this is a whole sense of pacification, and as well having no really any power to change the system itself or how anything works. And so rounding off that way, we could see sort of the way in which Marcuse is being critical of any sort of utopianist ideas, or sort of a view in which Marx is suddenly just, if only everybody gains class consciousness, for instance, it's just a simple matter of going out and breaking your chains and having a revolution. Well, Marcuse, from rounding off on chapter 6, is more or less saying there's no such thing as revolution in modern 60s society anymore. Why not? Because pacification's built into the system. Everybody's meant to be content and happy, and people who are ultimately could be disgruntled with the system, and the workers really have no any power to change that system at all. But let's round off on a slightly upbeat note, and to say that we have within 1964 discussion of One Dimensional Man, then that relation into and specifically focusing on work, as well as we have within the interview itself, this whole discussion about, well, what if there has come such a time in which precisely things have to change, in which precisely work time is marginalized and free time is much larger and so forth. Within a contemporary context, then, it makes it incredibly interesting for specifically this chapter and what Marcuse wants to say, because Marcuse, within the 1960s context, says, well, we can't think of a future in which this would arrive at. But now, within a contemporary context, at least these are starting to be questions that are starting to come to the forefront, let's say, because of the role of robots. And that's one of the main lines of arguments that Elon Musk has within Tesla, for instance, is that because of the looming horizon of robots and the way in which that's going to affect everyday work, there's going to have to be precisely what Marcuse was calling for in the 1960s, a complete transvaluation of exactly how we think of work in the first place. So many thanks for listening to the episode. In the next episode, we'll be continuing on reading through Marcuse's One Dimensional Man, getting stuck into chapter 7. In the meantime, feel free to drop me an email at my address at dissectingphilosophy@gmail.com. Feel free to check out the Patreon page at www.patreon.com/dissectingphilosophy, where there's a full discussion of Slavoj Žižek's Pandemic 1, as well as an ongoing discussion of Žižek's Pandemic 2, which is discussing coronavirus in our contemporary situation. The first episodes for those are completely free, whilst each subsequent episode is £5 or your regional equivalent for a subscription. Feel free to also tip me a coffee at coffee.com/dissectingphilosophy, ko-fi.com/dissectingphilosophy, and lastly, I can be found on Twitter at @IAmARobberMan. Many thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me next time.